This is Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle, one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time. Terry Bradshaw, now a broadcaster with Fox, made it official after the Super Bowl 51 victory. Coach Bill Belichick, the greatest coach of all time.
5 out of 7, Bill Belichick, Coach Belichick. Up over here on this side, Coach. Well, there's so much debate about who's the greatest coach in the history of the NFL tonight that got solved. That would be you, my young man. Congratulations.
Thanks, Terry. But look, it's all about these players. We got great players. They're tough, and they compete.
Less than 2 years after that celebration comes the New York Times bestselling book, Belichick, The Making of the Greatest Football Coach of All Time. And the author of that book is our guest on Sports Jam. Ian O'Connor joins us. Ian is the senior writer at ESPN.com, a nationally acclaimed columnist, and the author of 3 previous books, including the New York Times bestsellers Arnie and Jack and The Captain, The Journey of Derek Jeter. And now comes his 3rd New York Times bestseller, Belichick, The Making of the Greatest Football Coach of All Time. Ian, great to see you, and thanks for joining us on Sports Jam.
Hi, Doug. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. This took you quite some time to put this together. 350 interviews, but not one with Coach himself. So tell us, was that frustrating for you?
Well, it was, but I knew 3 years ago when I signed up for the project that that likely would happen, that he would not cooperate because Belichick is not a cooperative type of individual. So I wasn't surprised by it. I was a little disappointed that he reached out to some friends and associates, either directly or through one of his aides, and asked those people not to cooperate. I was a little disappointed in that. On the other hand, he doesn't owe me anything, and I was prepared to pretty much deal with any obstacle he put in front of me, and he did put some in front of me. And I almost felt at times, Doug, like one of his players, where he does put hurdles in front of them to make them better. And I really do feel like it made me better in some ways as a reporter, that I had to mine additional sources and work around those obstacles as best I could and really dig deeper to find information behind those Kremlin-like walls in New England. And I do believe I pulled it off.
You made a prediction back in a column in 2000 that may have even motivated you more to write this book. Tell us what that prediction was.
I thought it was the New England Patriots and Robert Kraft, their owner, had made a bad hire in hiring Bill Belichick. And the reason, there are a few reasons. His failure in Cleveland as a head coach, 4 losing seasons out of 5. His personality certainly didn't match up with that of the notions I think most people had of a successful head coach in the NFL, the lack of any charisma, leadership personality that you would see in a Bill Parcells. He didn't have that. His public personality, dealing with the media, was dreadful in Cleveland. And really, his surreal exit press conference from the New York Jets hardened all those notions and suspicions about him. It was a bizarre escape from New York after 24 hours as head coach of the Jets to go to New England. You put all that together, plus on top of that, he spent 12 years as an assistant with the New York Giants, and the people at the top of that organization had no belief in him as a head coach, never thought he would succeed. And that's the reason, frankly, they didn't give him the job after Parcells left. So I think 75% of the NFL had that opinion that he would fail in New England. And I certainly did, and I wrote it, and that column has haunted me for 18 years. And that did inspire me to some degree to examine why and how I was so wrong, and really why and how so many people around the NFL were wrong as well.
I like the fact that you admit it, though, because a lot of times we hear people on, whether it's sports talk radio, they give these predictions and then there's no follow-up. And, you know, so you really followed up.
Well, I had no choice, though. I mean, there were people who on Twitter and social media who found the old column, and I did a Q&A with Boston.com on it. So those who didn't know about it found out, or those who had already long forgotten about the column. But many Patriots fans over the years have reminded me on social media platforms about that erroneous call, and I will take it to my grave.
Well, I can tell you this. I never wrote an article about it, but I wasn't sure Larry Bird would be a huge success in the NBA because he couldn't jump.
Oh, there's so many. Listen, Tom Brady, who I believe is the greatest football player of all time, was drafted 199th in 2000. So even Bill, missed on him six times. Brady was the seventh Patriot chosen in that draft. Look at all the very intelligent, hardworking scouts and coaches and executives who passed on Tom Brady. Bart Starr won five championships for the Green Bay Packers way back when for Vince Lombardi. He was drafted 200th in his draft in 1956. He didn't even play his senior year at Alabama. So scouts and coaches can be just as wrong as I was in that column I wrote about Belichick in 2000.
But what you do get right is the real background of what makes this guy tick. And that's why I wanted to have you on the show, Ian, because when it comes to the making of Bill Belichick, he certainly had a major influence from his father. Mm-hmm. And you talk about his father, Steve. Let's go back to the moment that you really think that maybe really shaped Bill Belichick to a point where he could handle any type of player on his team. Tell us about the Okinawa story about his father, Steve, and Samuel Barnes as part of the U.S. Navy.
Right. Steve Belichick was quite a man. He really was, Bill's father, and he was serving in the U.S. Navy during World War II, stationed on Okinawa. He was in a segregated officers' club at the time, and in walked Samuel Barnes, who later became an executive with the NCAA. And Barnes was one of the first black officers in the U.S. Navy. He walks in, and every white officer in the club walked out in protest except for Steve Belichick, who sat down, had lunch with Samuel Barnes. They became friends. And Barnes' daughter, Olga, told me for the book that they became roommates for a brief period of time as well. And that's not something you saw back then. We're talking 1944-ish. And so I think Steve Belichick, his wife Jeanette, was a language teacher in college at Hiram College in Ohio. They just instilled in Bill values that were really ahead of their time in this country in terms of black and white. And I think people have looked at Belichick and his style of coaching and how curmudgeonly he is, and he just comes across as the ultimate old school guy. How does he relate to the modern player, the modern athlete, particularly the African-American athlete? And I think just coming out of that household in Annapolis, Maryland, where those values were instilled with him, really gives you an understanding as to why that that connection, at least behind closed doors, because the figure he presents in public would lead you to believe he'd have a hard time connecting with anyone. But I think one-on-one, he's underrated in that way, and I think the way he has connected with athletes of all colors and creeds really does speak to the way he was raised by his parents.
Now, a previous guest on Sports Jam was Scott Pioli, who you talk about in the book, obviously working with the Patriots through their Super Bowl, their first few Super Bowl seasons. When he talks about Tom Brady, he talks about somebody he's never seen work harder and be such a competitor. Now, that is also the same when it comes to Bill Belichick, but I thought it was interesting how you go back into his time when he followed his dad around, when his dad was doing coaching, and to a point where that you mentioned that Joe Bellino, the Navy running back who won the Heisman Trophy for Navy, said that the dad, Steve, picked out the opponent's weakness and attacked it. We know from just watching a most recent Super Bowl that the Patriots are never out of it, and halftime adjustments are what Belichick and Brady are all about.
That's right, and Steve Belichick was a master of that. I think he might have been, at the time, the best advanced scout in college football in the country, working for the Naval Academy for many, many years, and they would play heavyweight opponents, whether it was the University of Washington at the time, and Steve Belichick noticed that swing passes, I believe, to the left, they were vulnerable to, and so they did that and ended up winning the game against Washington and playing a powerhouse team at the University of Michigan and noticing that one of their star halfbacks who played both ways on defense, he would come up aggressively against the run. So if we fake a run and throw a pass, we can go over his head, go over the top. Steve Belichick put a play in, and the Naval Academy ran that play and ended up beating Michigan for a touchdown on that very play. So there were people in that program in Annapolis who said that Steve Belichick could win a football game on Saturday for you on Monday or Tuesday before that game, just with some of the things he would pinpoint, a weakness, a strength of the other team that perhaps Navy could neutralize. And Bill learned so much from his father, just from age 6, 7, 8 on, following him to games he would scout. He would watch how meticulously his father in the press box would break down plays and how he would chart things and how he would run a meeting room in the old Navy field house on Monday, Tuesday nights. And so I think people might assume that Steve Belichick really imposed his profession on his only child. He did not. I think Bill gravitated towards coaching because he just saw how his father adored the craft and loved it so much. I think Steve Belichick was happy to let his son do whatever he wanted to do, but I think it was the love that Steve had for coaching and developing young men. And at the Naval Academy, I had players say that Phil McConkey, the former Giant, was one of them, that Steve wasn't just developing us as athletes. He was developing us as combat officers because that's what we were going to be. And so I just think Bill saw how impactful his father was on the lives of the young student athletes and naturally gravitated toward that profession.
We're speaking with Ian O'Connor, who's the author of Belichick, The Making of the Greatest Football Coach of All Time. During his time when he was around the Naval Academy and some great players, he touched fame in all different ways. Roger Staubach playing catch with him at a young age. I would just imagine when just having somebody like that I guess some of these things just rubbed off on him somehow.
It's funny because growing up in New Jersey, my idol was Roger Staubach, and I think in some ways Staubach was one of Bill's idols as well. Joe Bellino, another Heisman winner at the Naval Academy you just mentioned. But yeah, Bill would play catch with Roger after practice. And interesting side story about that is Roger Staubach being my childhood idol and who I wanted to be, I obviously reached out to him to talk to him for this book, and he agreed to the interview. And all of a sudden, 3 days later, I get a message from his assistant saying that Roger has to cancel, but there was no mention of rescheduling. I have to believe what happened there. And I tried to call to get an explanation or a possible new date for the interview, and I never got a response. And his assistant returns all calls. So I think they clearly were avoiding me. I think Roger reached out to Bill, who said he'd prefer he not do the interview. So Roger canceled it. So that's okay. I did have another occasion to speak to my idol years earlier. So I have at least done that. But Bill was around so many great people at the Naval Academy, his father certainly being one of them. Wayne Harden, the head coach, he learned a lot from him. And even his father ran a football camp, and Bill spent time around Johnny Unitas and Don Shula. And so many great men really had a major impact on him. And his high school coach in Annapolis, Al Larimore, another very impactful figure in his life. Ted Marchibroda, his first coach in 1975 with the Baltimore Colts, really a great mentor to Bill. So he was born and raised to be a coach, even though, as I said earlier, Doug, Steve Belichick did not really impose that profession on him at all.
Big Al Larimore, you refer to him as grizzly bear of a man, shaped Belichick's vision of how to properly prepare a football team. From early on, this guy was getting a lot of the things that we see make him different than a lot of other coaches. He had that instilled in him at a very early age. It's hard to believe sometimes that maybe that really was part of his DNA.
It was. And in Annapolis, the lives of those football players at the academy on and off the field, it was all about urgency and precision and execution and protecting your teammate, your brother, whether it be ultimately down the road in combat or on the football field. Those things really shaped Bill, and he saw how important it was to developing not only the individuals, but a team, a real team. Al Larimore at Annapolis High School, there were a few things there which I think really had a major impact on Bill. He ran, in a football context, solely, he ran four or five plays, basically running plays, off tackle. The opponent knew what was coming, and he felt if we execute and we're precise in our blocks and our schemes, we're going to beat you anyway. And I don't care if you know what's coming. We're going to perfect these four or five plays, and we're going to win the game with them. And that's what he would do. So it was all about execution with Al Larimore. Another more important, more profound thing that Larimore was big on was just equality. And Bill started his high school days at Bates High School, which was a predominantly, if not all, black school in Annapolis before desegregation, and spent a couple of years there. And so when Bates became a junior high school, Bill and some white students and many black students went over to Annapolis High School, which had been a predominantly, if not all, white high school at one point. So Al Larimore was really at the forefront of educators in that high school who believe that we discriminate only against those who don't work hard and who perhaps in a football context aren't very good players. But that I think did have a major impact on Bill as well, that Larimore saw no color, that he was fair to everyone who went out to his for his football team. And I think that Bill saw how a coach needed to basically give every opportunity or every fair opportunity to every member of a team. And I do think that that was something that carried with him through his NFL career.
Ian O'Connor was raised in Englewood, New Jersey, St. Cecilia High School. Yeah, the same one where Vince Lombardi coached.
Let's go now, a little life out here. Let's have a little life out here. We look like we're half dead out here. Let's move a little bit.
So is it blasphemy that you say that Bill Belichick is the greatest coach of all time?
Yes, it is. And the priests and nuns at St. Cecilia would be most disappointed. I'm sure I would have to serve at least a couple of detentions after school for doing that. But, and let's face it, tragically, Vince Lombardi died young. And had that not happened, I imagine he wins a couple of Super Bowls in Washington, and we're having an entirely different conversation. But I think that Belichick, with not only longevity, but when you look at the dynasty he's built in New England, the fact that he has successfully raged against the NFL system, and that system is based around the idea that parity is a virtue. And the whole system is set up to prevent Belichick from doing exactly what he's done in Foxborough, and that is build a dynasty. When you look at free agency, the salary cap, the draft, even the schedule, they're all designed to take teams at the top and drag them back to the middle and elevate the bottom feeders. And so you're not supposed to do what Bill has done, which is go to 8 Super Bowls and win 5 of them since 2001, win 15 division championships, and if it wasn't for a couple of plays against the Giants, maybe has 7 rings instead of 5 as a head coach. So I think, given that he's done it in the time and place in the NFL that he has done it, that to me gives him the slight nod over Lombardi, who I would put at number 2. I would put Paul Brown at number 3.
You're listening to Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. My guest is Ian O'Connor, the nationally acclaimed columnist and senior writer at ESPN.com and the author of 3 New York Times bestsellers, the most recent, Belichick, The Making of the Greatest Football Coach of All Time. Well, Ian, we know he's not the greatest when it comes to press conferences.
I was really proud of the team today. I thought we competed hard. Green Bay's a good football team. Talked all week about how difficult they are to prepare for, to play against, and they were. They certainly gave us a number of problems in a number of areas. But you know, we battled through it. We were able to make enough plays.
Should we be okay with the fact that Bill Belichick is his own man and doesn't care about what we think about him? Can't we just respect the fact that that's the way he is?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I know some of his friends are just wish that America understood or knew the friendly, warm, sometimes even charming and engaging person that they see in social settings. One friend told me that if you were surprised walking into Bill at a function, the fact that he was human, that he was charming, it would be like being surprised if you walked into Steve Carell at a party and were and you thought he was going to act like Michael Scott in The Office. That the difference between workplace Bill and human Bill is that wide. And so I'm okay with it. I think most people probably are. And if you understand, too, the reason why he is the way he is in his news conferences, and sometimes he does belittle reporters and bully them. And he did this more in Cleveland and more in his early years in New England than I think he does it now. But there are times when he goes too far with it. But the strategy is that where it's built around the idea that we're in the business of collecting and gathering information and not sharing it. Therefore, when you ask me a question, I'm going to give you as little information as possible, be as disagreeable as possible, and I want my players to follow that lead. And they do. When you ask a Patriot a question in the locker room, and I've done this numerous times, that player is going to never speak about speak for somebody else other than himself, and he's going to give you as little information as possible. And that is the way Belichick wants it. I can also tell you, Doug, that he's coached against head coaches in the NFL who he believes have been too candid with the news media during the week, and he's used that information against those coaches on Sunday when he plays them. So that's why he runs his team with the opposite approach.
One of the famous coaches that you mention in your book, Belichick, is the great Chuck Knoll, who led the Pittsburgh Steelers to four Super Bowls in the 1970s. I also like the fact that Steve Belichick was born in Manassas, which is not far from where I was raised in western Pennsylvania. Do you think when he saw all these different coaches, he took something from each one, or is he his own man?
Well, I think both. I think he certainly took from his high school coach, Al Larimore, I guess starting with his father. It's really his first coach. But Larimore and the things I mentioned, I think his prep school coach at Andover, Steve Sirota, who played with Vince Lombardi at Fordham, he took from him the idea that you can change your schemes. He was the opposite of Larimore. He said, you know, you could be a chameleon and match up your schemes week to week based on the opponent you're facing. You don't have to be a system team. Sirota was also a very, very much a stoic on the sideline. And I think one of the things I've always really appreciated about Belichick's coaching style from a distance is that, unlike Parcells, Bill Parcells, he doesn't coach through volume and volcanic eruptions. He is very even-keeled for the most part on the sideline, not only during games but in practices. Now, where he will reprimand you and cut you in half is with his dry wit and humor and sarcasm in a film room, in a team meeting room. And he'll do that to Tom Brady in front of everyone, which actually has, to me, a positive impact on the team. One of the reasons why they did win five championships is because he holds Brady as accountable in front of the entire team as he'll hold the last guy on the roster. And I do think that has been a big part of the program in New England. But Steve Sirota had a major impact on I think Ted Marchibroda being that first NFL coach, he was a gentleman of the craft, but a guy who on car rides, they would stay out at a holiday, Howard Johnson's at the airport, and Bill would drive in with Ted Marchibroda every day from that Howard Johnson's to practice and listen and absorb and just listen to Marchibroda talk about building a team. And that year, 1975, was a very important one for the Colts. They had hit some down years after the iconic run of Johnny Unitas and those great teams. And that 75 team that Bill was a part of, his first year in the NFL as an assistant, brought the Colts back. They had a big winning streak at the end of the year. They started off slowly and sort of reignited the love affair between the Colts and that town. And Bill was part of that, and he saw it. And I think that also was something that shaped him. And Parcells really, I mean, people ask me a lot, and I talked to 350 people for this book, and even those I interviewed would say, what was the real relationship between Bill Parcells and Belichick? And they were never friends. That doesn't mean that Parcells didn't have wasn't a strong influence on Belichick as a coach, but they had ultimately very different styles. And I do think that Belichick did learn a lot from Parcells, but he took the good of Parcells and he left behind the bad, at least in his mind. And I think he ultimately ran his program and his team an entirely different way.
Yeah, that seems to all make sense. And coaches and quarterbacks don't always have to get along. If you listen to Terry Bradshaw, he always had a riff with Chuck Knoll. And Chuck even played Joe Gillum over him and Terry Hanratty at times over him. So you don't have to always get along to make things work. You can talk to band members who make music. They'll tell you about it, and you find out later, oh, we hated each other, you know, but they made great music together. And a coach, when it comes to Brady and Belichick, a dynamic duo, that it doesn't really matter that they have to really like each other that much. I wanted to talk about one of the other things that I really enjoy about the book is, after you talk a lot about the success and the mistake by the lake when he's with the Cleveland Browns, you talk about the human Bill Belichick. Tell us about the Frank Edgerly story.
Well, Frank Edgerly was a high school coach, and had only been really a high school coach when he was hired by Belichick, which for starters tells you a little bit about Bill and how he's always thinking outside the box. And if he thinks somebody can help our team and our organization and program, I'm going to try to bring that person in. I'm not going to be dissuaded by a resume that doesn't show him coaching at the highest levels of Division I college football or in the NFL. I think this guy has talent. He can identify talent. And so I'm going to bring him into the program. And so, and I know right from the start, Frank Edgerly never felt like he had to walk on eggshells around that building, that he was treated right away as an equal, even though he was a high school coach. But he had a family member, a sister, who was suffering from a very severe case of, well, she had cancer. And so it looked like it might be terminal, or at least she was in she was in very dire straits. And she was in Iowa in a hospital suffering dearly. And Bill got word of it through somebody in the organization. And with Nick Caserio, who was one of his executives, arranged for Frank to spend time away from work in Iowa so he could be with his sister in that hospital. And he was not told, and of course they paid for everything, the Patriots, but he was not told you have to be back at work by this point. I think a lot of football fans around the country assume that Belichick is a taskmaster and everything is about football and he doesn't care about anything else outside of it. That's not really true. It's not true at all. So this is just one small example. I have a lot of these in the book. And as it turned out, that was the last time Frank Edgerly ever saw his sister. So had he not been granted that opportunity, and when he got back, it wasn't as if Belichick said, okay, well, listen, now you're behind and we need you to catch up and spend extra time at the office and what you missed. It was none of that. It was just basically the tone was, the vibe he got, the feeling in the building, if you need to go back, you can. And so there are a lot of anecdotes in the book, I think, that show that human side of Bill. And there are friends and associates I talked to, Doug, for the book, who are frustrated that Bill never shows that side in the public arena, that at age 66, if he hasn't done it yet, I don't think he's going to start doing it. But his college lacrosse coach, Terry Jackson, contacted Bill. This is around 2004, effectively telling him that his wife was dying of cancer and on her bucket list was to attend a Super Bowl. She had never done that. Bill arranged for that to happen when they played the Eagles in Jacksonville and beat the Eagles that year. Bill hosted Terry Jackson and his wife, spent a lot of time with her, and then unfortunately, tragically, she died months later. So that's the human being that he does not, that one-dimensional character he creates at the podium in his news conferences is not really who he is 24/7, even though I think there are a lot of people around the country who believe that's the case.
Frank Edgerly is back as head coach at Red Bank Catholic High School.
He's back there now, and he's doing a wonderful job. He's one of the best high school coaches in the state, if not America. Yeah, so he did go back after his time in the NFL. He had spent some time with the Cleveland Browns as well.
Spygate and Deflategate. Have we blown it out of proportion because we're jealous of the Patriots or not?
Deflategate got out of control, and I think that really was, and Seth Wickersham and Don Van Natta of ESPN.com wrote about this, did a terrific job, a piece on how really Deflategate in some ways was a makeup call to the owners from Roger Goodell, the commissioner, who thought Roger had gone too easy on the Patriots in Spygate. Therefore, this happened again. You've got to drop the hammer. And that's why I think it really became the ordeal and circus it became for far too long. That case just dragged on and on and on. And frankly, Belichick and Robert Kraft were deemed innocent by the Wells report. Ted Wells was the investigator who ran the inquiry and came away believing that Tom Brady was involved in the scheme to deflate footballs improperly, but that Belichick and Kraft had nothing to do with it. But yet they were fined and they lost a draft pick. And so I always thought Brady should have been punished if that was the finding. But I never quite understood why Kraft and Belichick were punished when they were cleared in that investigation. Spygate to me was perfectly legitimate, and there are people I know, football fans and writers, media members I respect, who disqualify Belichick from the greatest ever conversation because of Spygate. I look at that case, and I really wish if Bill had cooperated with this book, I wanted to ask him this question. It seems to me that the advantage was not that profound, but the risk was. why did you take the risk when the reward was not that great? He's right. Bill was right when he said 80,000 people can see the opposing coach giving the signals. What Belichick did in filming those signals illegally from the sideline was he expedited the process of figuring out what those signs were, but he was not found to have used that information in real time in the same game, which would have given him a fairly big advantage. So I would have loved to hear the answer to that question, particularly when Eric Mangini, the head coach of the Jets, your former assistant, told you in 2007, do not do this in my building. He gave you the warning, and you did it anyway. You got caught, and it really changed how America looked at Belichick's program forevermore.
Another thing I really enjoy about reading Belichick, the making of the greatest football coach of all time, we're speaking with Ian O'Connor here on Sports Jam. Those little nuggets, those little things that you mentioned here. Harry Carson writing the letter to Art Modell of the Browns saying that this is the guy that you should hire. You should hire Bill Belichick.
And Bob Knight also contacted Modell. At some point, Bill Parcells did as well. But Harry Carson, what's interesting there, and I talked to Harry about this and many other players at the time, when Belichick first arrived as an assistant coach, the Giants' defensive players had absolutely no respect for him. They thought he was too young. He was disheveled-looking, the product of his father, who was an established college coach. He was a product of daddy ball, and he didn't know anything. And so, therefore, they didn't respect him. I had one linebacker, John Skurapan, tell me that we abused him. He used that word, abused. So if Belichick said, Harry or another one of the players, can you turn off that light on the wall there, that light switch, we're about to watch film, the player would say, no, you do it. And it was almost like second-grade stuff. But Belichick faced this every day because his defensive unit had zero respect for him. Now, over time, when the players and, of course, Lawrence Taylor came in, Carl Banks, so you had some really great defensive players who were acquired by the Giants over time, and everyone starts to realize, wow, this guy's actually good. He's putting us in position to win and to make plays on defense. So the respect that Belichick built over time, it was amazing. By the mid to late 80s, that defense, those players looked at themselves as Belichick guys, not Parcells guys, or at least Belichick guys first, Parcells guys second. The transformation from 1979 to that point was amazing because they really had absolutely no use for Belichick. I did not know that going into my research and before I started interviewing many of these Giants players. But that really blew me away that Harry Carson and others just said that Belichick in their minds was an absolute joke. And he certainly proved otherwise over the years.
When he does go into the Hall of Fame, who's going to be the person he selects as the person who brings him into the hall with a speech?
Well, it's a great question. I think that he should select Tom Brady. And I think he will. There are some other people that he might have in mind. Ernie Adams, his longtime assistant and former classmate at Andover, might be one, though Ernie is certainly not a person who gravitates toward the spotlight. I think that there's such a partnership, Brady and Belichick, the greatest partnership in the history of the league, and Bart Starr and Vince Lombardi are right there too, but I think he's the right guy. And even though that their relationship over the years has been purely transactional, and according to Tom Brady Sr. and others, they've never once even gone to dinner. I think that they realized that without each other, this never could have happened, that Belichick never would have had this kind of career without Brady, and Brady feels the same way. Now, do I think they could have won a championship or two with other people? Yes, absolutely. But I think there's no way they win five with other people. So Tom Brady, even though their relationship temporarily unraveled and got derailed last year, it's kind of amazing that it took 18 years for that to happen when they're working in close quarters every day, every week, every month for 18 years under intense pressure to be the greatest ever at what they do. And for last year to be the first time that a fracture in their relationship came into public view, I actually think that's remarkable. So I think once they get past this moment in time they had, which was pretty tumultuous going into the offseason, and they finish out their careers, maybe they will go to dinner. Maybe there will be some love and affection and warmth in the relationship that doesn't exist now. But either way, whether or not that happens, I think Belichick and Brady will look at each other and say, boy, what we had together was really, really special. And maybe we should have enjoyed it a little bit more as it was unfolding. But I think that Belichick will ask Brady. I think he should ask Brady. I think it'll be fascinating to see that one play out.
You've also authored New York Times bestsellers Arnie and Jack, obviously about Arnie Palmer and Jack Nicklaus, and The Captain, The Journey of Derek Jeter. So you don't just focus on one sport, you focus on a lot. Do you remember the first sports article you wrote that you said, or at least maybe somebody else said, this is pretty good, Ian?
Well, by the way, this book on Belichick did make the New York Times bestseller list, so it's my third in a row. My first one out of the gate, it's my fourth book, was I spent a year with Sebastian Telfair, who was a basketball prodigy in Brooklyn. I spent his senior year of high school with him out in Coney Island to do a book on the process of AAU coaches and agents and sneaker companies sort of all revolving around this figure, big high school figure in New York basketball. And I learned a lot about how to write a book. And I sort of think, going back to your question, that book was the result of a piece I did when I was a copy boy and clerk answering phones and getting lunch for people at the New York Times in the late 1980s. Pretty much just out of school, I had spent a little time at a bureau of the Star-Ledger here in New Jersey. But there was a story I did in the late 80s about a guy named Earl Manigault. He was a New York City playground legend called the GOAT. And if you Google him, you'll see quite a bit about him. HBO ultimately did a movie on his life. And I don't know how I came across the knowledge that he was back in New York City, had spent some time in, I believe, South Carolina. He had been in jail, in and out of jail. He was an addict. And I found him in a park. And I basically wrote his life story. And at the time, I want to say this was 1988, the New York Times did not give bylines to clerks and copy boys. And so they ran the piece with a pretty sizable photo, leading the sports section with it without a byline. And it might have been 3,000 words, 4,000 words. So it was extensive. So people actually called the New York Times trying to find out who wrote that story. And Frank DeFord was one of them. Frank DeFord, who's maybe the greatest sports writer of all time, was about to start a sports daily called The National. The people of our generation remember that. A newspaper only lasted 18, 19 months at a time in this country where the economy was just awful. But Frank DeFord called, and he found out it was me, and he ended up offering me a job in large part because of that story. So I remember being in his office and talking about that piece and laughing about the fact that I didn't get a byline, but I got a job out of it. So when you asked me that question, that was the first image and thought that popped into my mind.
So who gets credit for you becoming this sports writer? Who's the first one that inspired you to love to write?
Well, it's a good question. I think there was a professor at Marist College where I went. Rick Smits, the former NBA player, was there when I was there for a couple of years, 7'4". He did not inspire me to be a writer, but a professor named David McCraw, who's now a lawyer at the New York Times, was really the first one to sit me down. I was a freshman at Marist and say, okay, what do you want to do with your life, and what do you like? And I said, well, you know, I love sports, and I always wanted to be the quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys. That's clearly not going to happen. And he said, well, what else do you like to do? And I said, well, I like to write. I've always been good in my English classes. And he said, why don't you put the two of them together and write for the college paper? So I did. And so that's really where it sort of started for me. And so I think of David a lot. And he really sort of gave me some direction. I had a few thoughts here and there coming out of high school that maybe that was something I'd like to get into, whether it was broadcasting or writing. But he was really the first person to sit me down and put me on that path. And I've spoken to classes at Marist and other colleges and high schools about the craft. And the one thing that I always try to leave students with is that, to me anyway, as a reporter, it's always about the reporting, the information. The writing will take care of itself. I think the one surest way to improve as a writer is to read, and then to write as much as possible. And there really is no other way. But at the end of the day, it's about information and reporting and always making the extra phone call, always conducting the extra interview. And that's helped me really in my career. I'm maybe not the most talented guy in the world, but I don't think too many people, when pursuing a story, work harder than I do in pursuing it, like I feel I did in this book. And that's the one thing I always try to leave aspiring journalists with, that notion that you don't have to be the most talented person in the room, but don't let somebody else outwork you on a story. And if you follow that path, things will work out for you.
So see if you can follow me. You get a phone call from Roger Staubach, and he says, I'd like you to do a story about me. I'd like you to write a book about me. And just about as you're ready to sign the dotted line, from the grave, Vince Lombardi calls and says, I only have a day. And so if you don't do it today and you do Staubach's book, you can't do mine. Which would you choose and why?
I would choose Staubach because David Moranis, who won a Pulitzer Prize, I believe he was at the Washington Post at the time when he won it, and has done tremendous biographies on Bill Clinton and others, and he did Roberto Clemente. He did maybe my favorite all-time sports book on Vince Lombardi, and I would feel like, well, that's already been done, and to try to match that, and even if I did, I probably wouldn't be able to pull that off. But so I don't know if there's been a definitive biography written about Roger Staubach, and I certainly don't intend to. I don't want to insult anyone if that's happened. So I just think because of Moranis's iconic career and book on Lombardi, that I probably would pick Staubach, who I'm not saying is as fascinating as Lombardi, because I don't think he is, but I think there are a lot of people from my generation from around the country who grew up admiring him, so that would be my choice.
Not only admiring him, but I feared him as a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, and what I consider one of the greatest Super Bowls of all time, where he almost brought the team back to beat those great Steeler teams. He's about the only quarterback that could move the ball on that team like he did toward the end, and almost, if he had a little bit more time, the Steelers might not have all those Super Bowls in the 70s.
If you think about it, Doug, too, if Jackie Smith makes that catch, right, and Staubach also gave away 5 years to the United States Navy, 5 years of his prime, and I think Landry also waited too long to replace Craig Morton with Staubach, so he has two Super Bowl rings, and your Steelers haunted my childhood, beating the Cowboys in those two Super Bowls. But I feel like Roger was a player who could have had four easily. And he ended up with two, which was fine. But he could have been one of the two or three greatest quarterbacks ever. But losing those 5 years maybe takes away from his professional career, but adds to his personal legacy as just a great American.
Would you like to talk about your son, Kyle?
Kyle, well, he just graduated from Syracuse University, and he is...
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, and he's now working at the World Trade Center for Legends, which is a marketing hospitality partnership between the Dallas Cowboys and the New York Yankees, which is interesting because a lot of people would hear that and say, well, certainly his dad must have had a role in helping him get that job. I actually had no role in it. I'm not saying that there were other interviews he went on where if I knew somebody, I might send an email or make a call. But I actually didn't know anybody at Legends who interviewed him. I didn't recommend him for the job or anything. So, and I grew up worshiping the New York Yankees and Dallas Cowboys. It's kind of funny that my son ended up working for Legends, which is a partnership between those two franchises. And I'm proud, too, that he's working at the World Trade Center. After what happened in 2001, the fact that that area of downtown has been really entirely rebuilt and he's part of it down there, I think, is a good thing. And so he's just started working there. He's months into his professional career, and so far, so good.
So another New York Times bestseller in Belichick, and you've received so much acclaim for your writing. But maybe what he has told you probably might mean the most to you. What has he said to you about your writing or this book?
He is a millennial. So reading a 455-page book on a football coach might not be at the top of his priority list. I think what he has said to me, what he enjoys about my writing is that I write about human beings instead of, and I always think it's more important certainly to write about a human being than a quarterback or a shortstop or a head coach in this case, or a golfer. And that's what I do. I write about people. I don't write about athletes. That's the way I look at it, or coaches. And this is what I wanted to do with Belichick, and my son has pointed this, that he thinks he what he appreciates the most about my writing is that I wanted to write a human portrait of a man and not a portrait of a football coach, and particularly a man that I think so few people know anything about of substance, right? And by design, from his end. So that's what I was after. I wanted to explain how he became, arguably anyway, the greatest coach of all time, but really give you an idea of what makes this man tick. And after doing 350 interviews, even though he wasn't one of them, hopefully I pulled that off.
Well, I certainly think you did, and I think those who read it will agree as well. Whether they agree that he's the greatest coach of all time, well, that's what sports are made of, to have these kind of conversations, right? Ian O'Connor, best-selling author, and his most recent work, Belichick, The Making of the Greatest Football Coach of All Time, yet another New York Times bestseller. Thanks so much for joining us on Sports Jam.
Thanks for the opportunity, Doug. I appreciate it.
Sports Jam is a WBGO News production. You can check out all the podcasts by going to wbgo.org/sportsjam. Find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on iTunes. Special thanks going out to Joe Favorito for hooking us up with Ian O'Connor, as well as Fox Sports and NFL Films for their help with the clips used in this program. Until our next Sports Jam session, I'll see you at the game.